Welcome to the Solari Report. This is the annual wrap-up for 2022, and we're here to talk about the big theme. And this is a really big theme. We're here with a wonderful colleague who you've met before in the Solari Report, Elsa von Hamlin. Thank you. Extraordinary reporter and researcher and author here in the Netherlands. We're in Stavoren today. We're filming in Stavoren, and you've very graciously come up to do this. Elsa has been writing on what we are calling, it's your word, and I think it's brilliant. So,
about pharma foods.
Pharma foods.
Yes.
And this is a topic that both Elsa and Corylyn have been writing about. So you've seen it on the Solari Report before. But it's all part of the story of controlling the food supply. And it's a very important story, and it's one that I personally have been avoiding because I did a deep dive into what was wrong with the industrial agriculture system, mm-hmm. and that was frightening enough. This one is, you know, I would say it's not going to be the most positive thing we've done this year, but it's absolutely important to understand. And when we were discussing this on the team, the roundup, I was discussing with Pete Kennedy, who runs the food series, and I was saying, you know, Pete, if we have not been able to inspire people to find and support their local farmers or to start gardening, mm-hmm. this will do it.
Yeah, I hope so.
Anyway, and I know on the backcasting that we did at the end of the year, you did a wonderful thing about people really discovering their local food and mm-hmm. local farming and how it made such a pivotal difference in 2023. Mm-hmm. And so if you can't inspire through the positive, this will inspire through the negative.
It's the carrot and stick.
Yeah, it's the carrot and stick. Okay, pharma foods. Let's just dive in and begin. Walk us through the different parts of pharma food, because there are lots of different aspects to this, mm-hmm. and there are lots of different words and names that people use. It's mm-hmm. still very fluid in terms of terminology. So describe to us the different parts of pharma food.
So basically, like if you talk about the new kind of meat, which is not really meat, it's a cell culture. So they take cells from an animal, they grow it, and they paste it into something that's supposed to resemble meat. They're not sure how to call this yet. So it was called in vitro meat.
Right.
So it's meat from a petri dish. Now they sometimes also call it cellular agriculture, or they call it cellular meat, or they call it cell cultured meat.
In your article, you're calling it lab grown meat.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Because it's grown in a lab.
Right.
And while researching it, when I was trying to understand what they're actually doing, what they're using is a biotech pharma process. It's the same process that they use to produce the active ingredients in vaccines, for example, mm-hmm. but they use this to make the meat.
Right.
So the more I was studying it, there's this other process. It's called precision fermentation. And it's actually an old technique. I think the first time it was used was to produce insulin. So they insert a foreign gene in a bacterium, and this bacterium then starts producing human insulin. So this is an old technique, but they're now very broadly applying this. So in the US, they are genetically modifying bacteria to produce milk or butter or collagen or vanilla.
Right.
And they say, well, this is animal-friendly milk. So it's not labeled. So it's on the market. It's not labeled yet.
Right.
But again, this process is a biotech pharma process. It's not a traditional food production process.
And one of the reasons that they are moving to develop lab-grown meat is because the plant-based meat is not being accepted by consumers.
Yes, the consumers don't like the taste, they don't like the structure, it doesn't have the right nutrition content, it's highly processed, so health-conscious people are not buying it.
Right.
And somehow they think that they will buy this lab-grown meat. But if you really understand how they make it, I can't understand how.
If they know, we'll get into labeling later.
Yeah,
they may not know. But if you as a venture capitalist or a financial person, if you look at the whole portfolio of what some people would call fake food or synthetic food or pharma food, you've got the plant-based meat. We've got lab-grown meat, but there's some other things too. What else?
So there's the plant-based meat, and then in the middle, it's the Impossible Burger. And what is the other one? But the Impossible Burger, it's not like the plant-based meat. It can be like made of beans or legumes.
Right.
It's processed, but it still kind of has natural ingredients.
Right.
And with the Impossible Burger, they use genetically manipulated soy that has a, it looks like the meat that bleeds, but it's based on genetic modification. So it's even way more artificial than the plant-based stuff. And then the synthetic meat or the lab-grown meat, that's really based on cell cultures.
And just to be a little bit more gruesome, we are also talking about lab-grown seafood.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And so let me just ask a sort of a taxonomy question. The GMO fish that they're letting out now into the wilds in the most frightening of ways, is that considered synthetic or is that considered?
I think that's under GMO. That's right. Well, the regular GMOs. Well, that's also in the... In the report, I describe something that I call the transhumanist toolbox,
right?
Because I noticed that there's all these different terms, and you need to understand all these terms before you understand what they are doing. So there's the regular, there's the old school genetic manipulation, where they insert a foreign gene into an organism.
Right.
Then there's the new genetic modification. They call this a new breeding techniques. To make you think it's like old school breeding, but it's not, because it's genetic engineering. And here they don't insert a foreign gene, but they make with CRISPR or other types of techniques, they make small cuts into the DNA, and then the organism self-repairs, and that will cause new traits. But they apply these techniques both to the cell lines that are used for the meat, but they apply it for bacteria.
Right.
They apply it to plants and to animals.
Right.
So if you go into the cell culture meat, it's a whole host of very artificial techniques that is being applied. So getting back to the salmon, that's just genetically manipulated salmon. But if you look at the lab-grown stuff or the pharma foods, it's really grown in a lab based on cell cultures.
Okay, so I just want to go, you have a great table right at the beginning of your report, and I should point out, we'll have this up on the website, but the alternative protein market, see, we go through the numbers. And the beauty of this is what we're watching, particularly since... really, you know, sort of starts in 2015, but by 2019, we are watching a tsunami of money being thrown at this whole world.
Yes.
Far beyond anything justified by any potential economics that we know of.
Yes.
And one of the questions, of course, you address here, and we'll get into is, you know, somebody, Mr. Global has clearly made a strategic decision to print and throw $1 trillion at creating pharma food. And so the question is, why? What's that about? And we'll get into that. But let me just go into some of the numbers. So you've been able to track for plant-based meat, egg, dairy companies, combined funding 80 to 21, $6.36 billion. Okay. Plant-based meat, egg, and dairy companies funding $1.93 billion. Precision fermentation technology aimed at alternative protein sector, 2013 to 21, $2.8 billion. Now, this is what you've been able to identify. We don't know, you know, in theory, there could be more. Precision fermentation aimed at alternative protein funding, $1.6 billion. Now, explain to us again, what is precision fermentation technology aimed at alternative protein sector?
So the alternative protein is that they want us to stop eating meat and drink regular milk. And so they are developing the alternatives and the broth.
So it's butter, milk, meat,
Yeah, but also insects are also alternative proteins.
Okay.
And precision fermentation are the genetically modified bacteria that then produce, milk or butter or the stuff that usually are produced by animals.
Right. So you're talking about sort of making the building blocks that you can then use to make all these different things.
Yes.
Okay. Lab-grown meat and seafood combined funding 2016 to 2021. $1.93 billion. And when you realize all of these are startups, that's a lot of money for startups.
Well, also because with the plant-based stuff, they are selling in supermarkets or McDonald's. But with the lab-grown meat, there's just one company that sells in Singapore, and all the other companies are they don't have any sales.
Right. Okay, so lab-grown meat and seafood funding 2021, $1.3 billion. Then insect-based for human consumption and insect-based for animal consumption, $62 million and $1.2 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in total, we're talking about a lot of money being thrown at something that can't generate any revenues, let alone a profit.
Well, and there's not really consumer demand for it. It's completely artificial.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's step back for a second. One thing I want to mention, we'll get into it later, that there's real concern that the consumers will reject this. So the theory is if instead we market this to pets and livestock, you know, we can get it into the food chain without the consumer rejecting it.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about the pet and...
So already for the insects, like a lot of people just don't feel enthusiastic about eating insects. So in the Netherlands, there's the largest insect producer in the world, and they produce for livestock and for pets. And some of my readers have been sending me pictures where they thought they just bought pet food. And then it says on a label, like it's 100% insect protein.
Right.
So they're already mixing it into pet food and into livestock food. And I think this is concerning because there was one report and they tested the insects on the market. And I think, 30% of them, they had parasites.
Right.
And so if your pets eat these insects... Then they, especially if it's a dog or a cat, I think if you give a reptile insects, they have the stomach to process this. But if you give this to animals that are not developed to process insects, then you're basically feeding your pets parasites. And pets are also a factor for parasites in humans. So already this is in a lot of pet food. So if you have a pet, I would start checking what the ingredients in the pet foods are. And there are also a number of startups for cell cultured pet food. They are not so they're startups. I don't think they're not being sold on the market yet.
Right.
But I think there are a number of reasons. Like the overt reasons that they mention is that the pets, they don't have a very distinguished taste. So you can feed it to them, and if the taste is bad, they will still eat it. But I also think there's less regulatory requirements.
Right.
And that goes more into how it's made. But you need something that's called a cell line, like a base cell culture, to produce this. And these are very difficult to develop. And if you make pet food, you can make some of the existing public cell lines. For example, there's a mouse cell line that's, I think, 30 years old, that's widely used. People know how these cells behave.
Right.
They know where to order the medium to grow the cells. And for human fake meat, these are major stumbling blocks. But for pets, you can say we can use a mouse cell line to produce this.
Right.
Yeah. And probably when people have been feeding it to pets for a while and they think, oh, it's not so weird, and you have seen it, and hopefully your pet didn't get sick, then perhaps they are more willing to eat it themselves. And I also thought if you realize what's in this, I wouldn't be surprised if some people that eat it can get very sick. And if your pets get sick, I think the liability is smaller than when humans get sick from eating it.
Right. The legal liability.
Yeah, because that's another discussion is that the companies that are promoting it, they say it's exactly the same as real meat. But if you understand what's in it and how it's made, it's really not the same.
Right.
And the consumer agencies that are warning about this, they say, we don't have any knowledge or data about the health effects of eating cell lines. Because very often these cell lines are cancerous cells, because that's right. What makes the cells grow. So we don't know what's going to happen if you eat cancerous cells, basically.
Well, the other thing is it's going to be very hard to prove that it was this thing as opposed to something else, especially if it's cancer.
Yes.
So basically, we're talking about a giant experiment.
Yes, very big experiment.
Right.
Yeah. Also, because some of the other ingredients, they can cause prion disease.
Right.
So there can be contamination. So there can be microfilm, like
right.
Yeah. So. They really don't know what's going to happen if you eat that.
So, and one of the caveats I want to stress, and I've said this to you before, is if you deep dive all the things that are wrong with industrial agriculture, there are plenty of horrible, gruesome things going on in the existing food system. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to make this out to be uniquely horrible and gruesome, because I can come up with plenty in the old system or the traditional system. And one of my biggest concerns with what's happening is if you have been a government regulator and you have seen the deterioration in the quality of not only government regulation, but of corporate quality control. The former head of Food Series on the Slee Report was a guy named Harry Blaser, who had built the largest fresh food market in the country, in the United States, and then sold it to Whole Foods. And Harry was one of the, he knew more about food safety than any person I've ever known. And he really tracked the deterioration in what corporations were doing. And at this point, whether it's the corporations or the regulators, the deterioration in the willingness to describe what's in things and do accurate labeling, but then also turned a blind eye to companies, you know, putting in things that are absolutely shouldn't be in it. And I mean, I don't trust in a U.S. supermarket. I don't trust, you know, if I can't see the meat in the original form, I won't buy it because I don't trust them. And so my lack of confidence in the integrity of the system is, I would say it's not at zero, but it's approaching.
Well, after researching this, I'm not going to supermarkets that often, but afterwards I feel kind of, I don't want to get my food there anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Because it's like running an obstacle course. You're reading the labels and you're thinking, you know, and at some point it becomes just, I give up.
Yes, but also like with fresh foods, they are doing so many experiments with the foods, like, for example, with the new genomic techniques. And they say, well, it's actually exactly like the real thing. So how do I know that what I'm eating is really organic or it's already manipulated? You really don't know.
Right. One of the things you point out is the organic label is not what we think it is.
No, it's right now it's still what it is. and I think since organic has become a business model, some people are idealistic and they want to do organic farming because of their ideals, and other ones just want to do it for the profit. And there's not sufficient oversight on it always. But both in the US and the EU, there's a real push to accept new genomic, the new GMOs.
Right.
The industry, their argument is that, well, these changes, these genomic changes, they could theoretically also happen by itself in nature. So that's why we shouldn't regulate them. But they say, well, it's our technique, so they need to be able to patent it. But the lobby push is that these new GMOs will be allowed on the market without testing, without tracking and tracing, and because they don't need to be registered, they will go on the market and nobody, because now in the EU, if you put a GMO on the market, you need to be able to test for it.
Right.
But if there's no test developed for it, then people, they can't recognize the difference between a traditional crop and a genetically modified crop. And the EU, they have these farm to fork goals, where they say we want to reduce pesticides use by X percent and we want to increase organic production. And now the commission has put out a number of reports where they say, well, the only way we can achieve these goals is by allowing these new genomic techniques. Otherwise, we won't be able to reach our sustainability goals. And a similar push is happening in the U.S. to allow GMOs under the organic label.
So we'll get to it, but the number of inversions of logic,
yes,
to use sustainability goals and climate change, uh-huh, to justify the totally uneconomic and scientifically insane, uh-huh, is unbelievable.
Yes.
My vision is there's a room somewhere, like at Hill and Knowlton or some great PR firm, where they just, you know, like invent these crazy things.
Well, this is interesting because for the GMOs, there's a Dutch consultancy called Schuttelaar & Partners. And the new GMOs, which is like CRISPR and a number of other techniques, they were called new genomic techniques. But that still had the word genomic in it. And people don't like GMOs because that's the red flag.
Right.
So they coined the term new breeding techniques because it's like breeding. We've been doing that for thousands of years already. But now the European Commission and abroad, everyone is using the term new breeding techniques. Because I remember discussing this with Cori Lin, because she said they kind of use breeding and genomic interchangeably. So I don't understand, are they doing the natural thing or are they doing the GMO? But they're calling GMOs breeding right now. So you will think like, oh, this is safe, this is fine.
So it's interesting. One of the challenges of getting your arms around this topic, and I think, you know, your report is the first thing I've ever seen that really helped me get my arms around the whole topic. But one of the hard things is the terminology is so fluid. Mm-hmm. And part of it is because, you know, the technology is evolving rapidly. But the other is because people are trying to come up with these insane ways of talking people into eating this stuff.
Yes, there's a very clear that there's some of the terms they are catering to the venture capitalist,
right,
who want to invest in high technology.
Right.
And other ones are looking at like, how are we going to sell this to the public and make this sounds normal.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. How are we going to normalize it?
Yeah.
Okay. So I want to tell you a story. I don't think I've ever told you the story. I forget when it was. I think it was 2015 or 2016. I was going to Sydney to see, uh-huh, Jason Bawden-Smith. And Jason was an environmental scientist who had a very successful business doing environmental consultancy. And so was a very well-heeled entrepreneur. And he said, what do you want to do in Sydney while you're here? Because we were going to go out to Uluru, mm-hmm, and then come back to Sydney. And I said, there's a TED Talk in, mm-hmm, Sydney at the Opera House. And I love the Opera House. Mm-hmm. Have you ever been to Sydney?
No. Oh, but I know
you have to go. Anyway, it's better to go to the opera at the Opera House. But, mm-hmm, you know, I said, there's a TED Talk, so let's go. So he got us tickets, and it turned out it was very hard to get tickets. It was sold out. We got tickets. And, you have lectures in the morning and then a luncheon and then lectures in the, mm-hmm, evening. Now, there's a beautiful cafe outdoors on they had a lunch as part of the event. Well, it turns out that they were feeding us insects.
Ooh.
All the food was insects. And they had this unbelievably woke, fashionable chef with his whole team. And they're, uh-huh, all very attractive and very fashionable. And they give this big video about insects are the new thing and they're going to be great. And, you know, and Jason's looking at me like, what is going on? I mean, I won't tell you the words he uses because he was a very Australian guy. And he said, okay. And we had like about, I don't know, five people together. He said, come on, we're going to the cafe for steaks. I'm buying everybody steaks. And, you know, we went by the place where you could pick up your insect meal, and we kind of looked at it, and somebody decided, okay, I'm going to try. And it tasted horrible. Mm. It looked horrible. It tasted horrible. And the most priceless thing that made it all worthwhile was watching Jason's face. He was like, you know, maybe we are being run by space aliens. it was so funny. And you could see they were putting huge amounts of time and money mm-hmm. into trying to make this stuff fashionable. And, you know, it was all climate change and that kind of stuff. And you thought, this is never going to work. It's never going to work. But they were giving it their all.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah. And it was kind of frightening to see that many sort of young, fashionable foodies trying to, you know, go with what the big guy wanted. Anyway. Okay, so I'm looking at one of your charts early on from 2016 to 2021, VC funding for food tech, $1.5 billion, $1.5 billion, $9 billion, $17.1 billion, $18 billion, $39.3 billion. Now, food tech is a wider basket, right?
Yes, food tech, it merges food and technology. So cellular meats or lab-grown meat falls into this category, but it also are these delivery meals such as HelloFresh or... Right. So basically how I would call it is it are all the technologies that will... through which you can get your food delivered to your home, and you don't need to leave the house anymore. And it's not grown in the fields, but it's grown in factories.
And it's delivered by a drone. Yeah.
Yes. And so food tech is also the vertical farms.
Right.
Yes.
Right. So one of the things we should mention, because we are in the Netherlands is a food juggernaut. It's the second largest exporter of food in the world. Now, a lot of it is coming through. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of European food coming through the Rotterdam markets, et cetera, the Amsterdam markets. So, but if you look at the food here, traditionally, the quality is extraordinary. Food is very plentiful mm-hmm. and the price is very reasonable. And yet we see the Netherlands do a deal mm-hmm. basically with the World Economic Forum. And before you know it, they're trying to drive all the farmers out of business with a variety of climate change excuses mm-hmm. and build this juggernaut of fake food.
Yeah, that's really interesting because the Netherlands is really at the forefront of agricultural development.
Right.
And it's the Wageningen University that's the hub of this. And what you see now is that the World Economic Forum infiltration in our government is a real problem.
Right.
Because there are a lot of high civil servants. They have a direct line with the World Economic Forum. For example, the World Economic Forum, they requested a 600,000 investment to create a food hub. And then the government just pays that. So it's a tax funder. It's funded by our taxes, and it's a World Economic Forum activity. Nobody has voted for that. We don't have any political party that has the World Economic Forum program in their political program. There are also a number of ministers that have very direct lines.
Right.
And the food makes a big part of this. So the World Economic Forum has all these food hubs worldwide. And in the Netherlands, there's the global coordinating of food hub.
Right.
And then the Wageningen University, they're basically the hub for all this very technocratic food production. So it's kind of interesting that we have so much agricultural production, but we're also really at the forefront of this technocratic food push.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So one of my favorite in this annual wrap up mm-hmm. with your report, we have a top stories and video section. Mm-hmm. And one of the sections is the great video of His name is Gideon von, yes, what's his full
Gideon
name?
Van Meijeren.
Yeah. Yeah. And he is challenging yes. Rutter on his letter to Klaus Schwab. And it's very funny.
Yes.
But he's pointing out the hypocrisy that's going on between between the government and what they're up to. But my favorite part was when he says, because in the letter, Rutter has said to Schwab, you know, thank you for your positive vision of the future. And so Gideon points out, you know, the positive vision of the future includes stripping people of their property rights. And is that your vision of a positive future, stripping all of us of our property rights? And, you know, Rutter's kind of squirming. It's pretty funny. Anyway, but it's one of the great pushbacks. Okay, so you talk about the origins of the idea of lab-grown meat, and you talk about the university here in the Netherlands. But tell us a little bit about the history. How did this get going? Where did it come from?
Well, that's interesting. The I think the idea was first floated by a Dutch professor in the 70s or 80s. Mm-hmm. But the first real project was a NASA-funded project where they wanted to find out if they could produce food during space journeys.
Right.
And in the same year, I think that was a Harvard project. That was an art project where they had a cell culture of frogs, I believe. And then they made food into it, and the frogs were hopping in the table while people were eating it to, I don't know, encourage new perspectives on food, which is kind of crazy.
Well, the French have always eaten frog legs, so it's not as...
But why would you want to have living frogs right, on your table?
So if you look at where the money's been coming from, you show that there's a huge amount of money coming from the U.S.
Yes.
And given how much money is disappearing from the federal budget, it's because between the central bank and the fiscal arm, we have a tsunami of money available to do these things. But money's coming from the Middle East.
Yes, too.
And if you look at the challenges they have, you know, they have to, you point out, you know, they have to import a huge amount of food. You can see why they might want to.
Yeah, they're not self-sufficient. So you see that Singapore, right. the Middle East, and China, they all have concerns about feeding their populations.
Right.
So that's their interest in this, to become self-sufficient for food production.
I'll never forget a Chinese gentleman who had political experience in China said to me, you have to understand, we don't care about the stock market. We care about the price of pork. Since the price of pork skyrockets, you know, we could get through, you know.
Yes. So in China, it's actually in one of the, in the recent 5-year plans, they have plans for development of new food technologies.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Because that was interesting, too. Like a lot of the most startups are in the U.S. Right. And then Israel has a lot of startups. The money is coming firstly from the U.S. and then the Middle East. But if you look at the target market, it's really China.
Right.
Yeah.
So what about India? Has India shown any interest in this at all?
Not that much. They're looking at how to regulate it, but they're not an active player, or they didn't come to the...
They're basically too fundamentally sane to...
Yeah, for us, yeah.
Okay, so the history continues, but we see this explosion of money from 2016 on. What happened?
Well, this is interesting. We have to go back a little bit before... There were a number, I think it starts in 2006-07, there were a number of universities or professors in universities that were looking at, like, can we produce this cell-cultured or lab-cultured meat? And it was considered kind of weird, so it was difficult to get funding for it. And then this NGO, New Harvest, was founded.
Right.
And this NGO, they ensured that there would be funding for these types of projects. They organized a number of pivotal conferences that connected all these researchers worldwide. And then, and what's interesting, the person who founded this NGO, he has very like deep state ties. So
right.
This is not like a neutral project. And then in 2013, the Mark Post of the University in Maastricht, he had said, well, I know we have the technology to produce this meat, but it's very expensive. We don't have the funding. And then Sergey Brin of Google, he put down, I think it was $300,000, and they produced the first lab meat burger. And that generated a lot of interest. Around that time, I think another NGO, the Good Food Institute, was founded. And you see that New Harvest still exists, but this Good Food Institute, they cooperate together with governments, they support startups, they help corporations right. develop it. So you really see that these two NGOs play a very big role in pushing this to market. And then starting 2016, there's this whole wave of like venture capital investments.
So one of the things I used to watch both on Wall Street and Washington is somebody would make a strategic decision. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to figure out lab-grown meat and do this. And then suddenly, you know, it happens at a very high level. Suddenly the spigot turns on here and here and here here. You got the universities, you got the companies, you got the investor, you know, just whoosh, it goes across the ecosystem. And many people can't imagine that there's that kind of integration. Mm-hmm. But there is. A strategic decision has been made. You're going to throw money at it. And part of it is you believe if you try, you know, the venture capital model is if you try 50 things, one will work and mm-hmm. that will justify losing money on the 50. But if you go fast like that, you'll get more faster. Mm-hmm. So you waste more to get more. And the economics work if it's mm-hmm. economic. Now, here, I don't see any sign that it's economic.
There was a very interesting article in Mother Jones where somebody compiled all the missed deadlines, like all these lab-grown meat startups, that where they said, well, we have this to market by this date. And it was just this list of missed deadlines.
Right.
And again, now there's just one company that's selling it and another company that just had FDA, like partial approval. Like it's a big hurdle, but it's not fully approved yet.
Right. Yeah. Right. I don't know. You know, that's the model. On Wall Street, for example, if a firm wanted to figure something out, they tell 10 people that they were in charge of figuring it out, and then they'd all go try and do it and then end up bumping into each other and competing. You'd have a huge mess, but their theory was we'd get to one that worked faster if we yes. did it that way.
But here they really don't seem to get it to work. And if you read the real experts, so chemical engineers that have experience with setting up these type of processes, they say this is just, it's not going to work. It's like... Yeah.
So you have some very funny descriptions here of so the one where you have to buy these fantastic bio, what's it called? A bio, the big equipment to make
the bioreactors. Yeah.
So you have to build and make these huge bioreactors mm-hmm. and then you have to run them. And there's a real problem of how do you get the quality control? Because the process of growing this stuff creates toxins. How do you, there's no capillary system around the toxins is the way you describe it. And so you've got these huge machines and you're creating the stuff and you're having to pull the toxins out. If anything goes wrong, if you don't do it near perfectly, you could lose fantastic amounts of money because one batch is so expensive. And you're reading all of this and you're thinking the energy consumption must be fantastic.
Yes.
You know, instead of a cow sitting out in the field enjoying the sun, you've mm-hmm. got this machine.
Well, also it's the machines for the energy consumption. Well, perhaps it's helpful to dive into how they make this. So if you buy a piece of meat in the supermarket.
Now, let me just stop. Yeah. Please do not eat while we're discussing this, because we're going to discuss. You know what? Okay. Put your dinner aside for now. Okay, go ahead.
So if you buy a piece of meat in the supermarket, you cannot grow a cow from it. Like it's dead meat. So you cannot grow something alive from something that's dead. So here does it start? Like if you, for a cell culture, you need living cells.
Right.
And to get a cell culture that exists for a long time outside of the body, you need to either genetically manipulate it, or it some cells that are like highly cancerous, they grow out of themselves. or fetal stem cells, they grow very quickly. But if you want something that's able to proliferate, you basically have to manipulate it.
Right.
Then you have to grow this cell culture, but you cannot start in this really big batch because this cell culture is very sensitive. So you have to add some nutrients to it. They call this the growth medium. So if you think about cells in the body, they are nurtured by your blood. Like the blood gives them nutrients and oxygen, and the waste products are also discarded off in your physical system. So this cell culture doesn't have that. But like to make the cells grow, you need to have a liquid that is very similar to blood. Mm-hmm. And very often they use real blood.
Right.
So the product that's on the market in Singapore, it uses FBS, fetal bovine serum. And this is blood that is tapped from living calves. But if you don't want to use this bovine serum, you need something else. And then again, they very often use the genetic manipulation again to, right. But it's very complex to, basically your blood has so many nutrients. It has the vitamins, it has what they call growth factors. It mm-hmm. are the chemicals that make the cells proliferate. So what's naturally in the natural substance, you need to substitute it. But it's a very complex product. And based on the kind of cells you use, you need to tailor this medium to the cells. So then you grow these cells, but you need to start like in a little flask first. And then you have a small bioreactor. You cannot start in this big bioreactor. And then it goes to like in bigger and bigger reactors. But the bigger it gets, the bigger the chances are that you have a contamination event. And if you have a contamination event, like
it's
bacteria...
It's unbelievably expensive.
Yes, and bacteria grow much faster than your cells because it's difficult to make cells proliferate outside of the body. Then you just have a bacterial culture. So your environment needs to be very clean. And the way they do this is in clean rooms. And basically, these are airlocked spaces. And depending on your grade of clean room, like there will be the people who work in it, they have to get a shower first, and then they get these suits, these hazmat suits, and then they're allowed to go into the place where this is grown. And this was actually a discussion in some of the papers, is because the lab-grown meat companies, they say, well, we can use food production standards to make this because that will bring the cost down. But if the chemical engineers that look at this, they say you need to have these extremely high quality standards. Otherwise, you will just make contaminated right. batches.
Right.
So the energy for these...
Think the energy usage would be fantastic.
Yes, but it's energy for the production. But the clean rooms, they have a very high energy use as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And your employees need to be trained to operate these processes. Otherwise,
right. We were talking about how they were hiring people who just couldn't relate to the extreme mm-hmm.
yes.
perfection of what standards and just.
Yes, you cannot just hire anyone. Like even if it's a blue collar worker, they need a very rigorous amount of training to understand how to work with the equipment, the behavior in the factories.
Right.
Because again, like small contaminations have extremely high cost because it's not just the ingredients in the batch, but you need to clean it out. They weren't so transparent about this in the literature, but I know that, here in Europe, these kind of production processes for biopharma, this is classified as hazardous waste, like biohazardous waste. So you need to discard of it with a processed waste processor, or you need to have on-site equipment to deal with it. But you cannot just
throw it out.
So then, like, you have the cost of the batch. You have the cleaning cost because you have something that's very contaminated. So you need to have like very rigorous training on cleaning Otherwise, your next batch will go wrong as well.
Right.
And then you have the waste cost and all your personnel that's working on this. So
you read this and you think this can't possibly ever be economic.
Well, that was my big question, because it uses the same process as for biopharma products, but these are very high margin products. And when you read this, then you think if you're
able... A hamburger is not a high margin. In the grocery business, is like 1 or 2%
yes.
margins.
No. So even if you're able to set up this process and produce this product, which they're not really able to do yet on a high scale, why would you produce something with the margin of a hamburger? I don't have an answer, but yeah.
So one of my favorite things is Wired magazine, Israel is a fake meat powerhouse. Yeah. So Israel is clearly doing everything they can to be a winner at high-tech everything, mm-hmm. or high-tech many things, but so it's not surprising you would see them. And of course, it's the Middle East. You're in a desert. So the food thing. But it says, despite the investments in the interest in lab-produced meat, religious experts are not yet in agreement about if a novel product is kosher. and I can't pronounce
it. Halal.
Yes. So you can see, I can just imagine the amount of money that will be thrown at the universities to come up with chipper explanations as to why this stuff is either kosher or halal.
Yeah, well, they're asking these religious leaders because there are these very strict rules about when you can eat something and how the animal needs to be slaughtered.
Right.
And here, like, well, is the cell line halal? Like, how did they get the cell?
Has anybody really come up with a theory on why? Okay. Ugh. Okay. So we've talked about the NGOs, we've talked about the universities, we've talked about NASA and the government agencies. We've got a lot of startups and private companies and VCs. And
well, what's important too is that after this VC capital wave, the large corporations are investing in this
too. So the conglomerates are here. Cargill is here.
Yes.
Right.
And like each big food conglomerate, they have an alternative protein section. That's interesting too, if you think about words. They're not calling it meat anymore. They're talking about proteins and alternative proteins.
Right.
So they're investing in this, and it's kind of concerning because if you look at the structure of the food market, basically every segment of the food market is dominated by an oligopoly. And sometimes there's also crossovers between these companies, but our whole food system already is highly controlled. So to see that these corporations are moving into this in a big way. Yeah.
So one of the things you get into is now we see promoted the idea of using human cell lines to grow this and different articles making, you know, if it's grown from human cell lines, it's human meat and why this is okay or fashionable. And this gets into a lot of the more gruesome topics that we're not going to get into, but, you know, is really happening. And I'll never forget, I was looking at the plant-based companies and I looked at one researcher came up with the fact that the Impossible Meat facility in Silicon Valley was in an industrial park. And it had no windows and no signage. So you couldn't tell that it was Impossible. Is it Impossible Food or Impossible Meats?
I think the company is Impossible Food, but it's Impossible. Yeah.
But it's meat of some mystery meat of some kind. I'm not clear if it's plant-based or what else. But so it had no windows and it had no signage. And what they alleged was it was next to a Cargill salt division and right next to a huge Planned Parenthood facility where they were doing abortions, you know, and it was right all there together. And if you got on the internet and went and looked and checked the addresses, that's what it appeared to be. But you thought, you know, I don't, given some of my interactions with some of these players in the past, I don't put anything by what should be going on here. Anyway, so a little gruesome, but the food conglomerates have come in.
Yes, and now they're calling in the government because in 2021 there was this many governments have their own cellular meat program. And you see the CEO of New Harvest, she said, well, you have all these startups and they're not really getting from the ground, but they don't have an infrastructure. So we need an infrastructure now. So they're lobbying all these governments, and there are a lot of governments that have initiated these platforms, right, to help these startups get off the ground.
Right. So I'm looking at these, the list of sort of the industry organization cooperation platforms.
Yeah.
Now you see this when you sort of, when the central bankers and the investors throw huge amounts of taxpayer or printed uh-huh. money at things, this is what you see. You see all these organizations suddenly have a tsunami of money, and you think, where did they all come from? It's like a wildflower explosion. Cultivated Meat Modeling Consortium, EIT Food, AMP Poultry and Seafood Innovation. It's always innovative.
Yeah, yeah.
National Institute for Cellular Agriculture, Feed for Meat, Cellular Agriculture Europe, Colnet Consortium, Israeli Cultivated Meat Consortium, mm-hmm. Open Cell Ag, Cellular Agriculture Netherlands, Cell Ag UK, Apex Society for Cellular Agriculture, that's in Singapore, Global Alliance for Advancing Cultivated Food, Alternative Protein Council. I mean, you can just see this. It's like the world's biggest job program.
Yes.
It's just. Okay, now I'm going to get into China, but I want to stop for a second. One of the best pieces in this report, there are many good pieces, but one of the really good ones is when you say, why would a sane, intelligent person do this? Mm-hmm. Why would Mr. Global turn on the tap? Uh-huh. What are the logical reasons why this is a good idea?
That was actually a major turning point, because I was reading this and like one thing is more insane than the other. And I thought, this is so insane. It became very frustrating. And then I thought, but under what circumstances would this be rational?
Under what circumstances would you do it?
Yes.
Right.
So then you get back to the NASA, like Solari has published a lot about the space program. And I thought, okay, if you need food production on a spaceship,
right. That, how are you going to do it? You can't.
Yes.
You can't bring cows, right?
Yes.
Right.
And then I saw. So his name is Jason Metheny, and he's the founder of New Harvest, and his expertise was in the Future of Humanities Institute about calamities that could potentially wipe out humanity.
Right.
And then I thought, okay, there are a couple of wild cards, like for example, meteor. Or a nuclear disaster, but there are instances where, yeah, that could potentially right. wipe out humanity. So if you need to survive for a long time in underground bases,
right.
then that will be rational to develop right. that.
Or we know if there's a solar minimum, the yes. agriculture production just crashes.
Yes.
And so the question is, okay, in that event, if you can't grow by natural methods, how can you grow food?
Yes.
Right.
And another part was that I thought, okay, it's very clear that they want to control the food system. And I think for the Mr. Global, it's necessary to have a food crisis
right.
to get enough people on the CBDC.
Right.
And if you see all these developments, like it's both the vertical farms and it's a cell cultured meat and it's the insects, all this food production is all within factory walls and it's fenced. So it's outside, like people don't have contact with their food anymore. It's highly patented. So, that goes into the regulation, but you see that the regulation is really pushing out real food production and making it impossible or difficult to produce regular food. And then you push this fake food, but then you have this food production that is controlled by these oligopoly corporations. So I think control is a major part of it, but it doesn't fully answer it because... like if people are 100% dependent on you, you don't need to offer them lab workers. You can offer them bread.
Right.
And then there was another interesting link is that so the the production process of this cell culture. Yeah, so you have the cell culture, you have the medium, you grow these cells, but then you have a cell slurry.
Right.
And to make it look like meat, you need to make it in kind of a structure. And the way they're looking at it is by basically using nanotechnology to create a structured meat. But this process...
This for me was one of the most frightening parts of your report, is how you turn the slurry into something that has some kind of skeleton structure, you know, some kind of body. Mm-hmm. And as you read the different ways they're trying it, you're like, what could possibly go wrong here?
But this process is called, in other ways, it's called tissue engineering.
Right.
Tissue engineering is the same as regenerative medicine, which is a subset of longevity research, which is one of the big areas where billionaires are investing in. So one billionaire was saying, like, well, at some point, like, a bigger yacht doesn't really make me happier, or like five extra yachts don't contribute to my happiness. So in the end, the thing that really matters is to have more life years.
Right.
And this is the longevity research. But if you look at the technology for longevity research is exactly the same technology as for lab-grown meats. Because the real question is, like, how do you make this, keep this cell alive?
Right, so there was a great quote where somebody says, you know, we're saying that we're studying lab-grown meat, but we're really spending a fortune, and I suspect of government and central bank money, figuring out how we can live forever, you know?
Yes, because there are like the longevity researchers, they're going into the lab-grown meat areas. Right. And a lot of these lab-grown meat startups, they will say, like, the real key for us to develop our product is what's happening in longevity research. So there's a major crossover there.
So one of my feedback, not from any kind of research or report, but from wealthy people that I know, is the advances they've made on using stem cells and other technology to really dramatically improve people's cellular health, you know, that's going on now is quite extraordinary. And I think one of the political challenges is, you know, the secrecy around that is extraordinary. And I don't think they want people that, you know, they're terrified of what if the knowledge of what they're doing to keep themselves young, if the knowledge that that exists gets out to the general population, they're terrified of what the backlash is going to be.
If you look at that, the stem cell part, because the if you look at the amount of abortion clinics, because they need like fresh fetal tissue,
right,
and the amount of stem cell clinics, it just doesn't add up. There must be a very
right,
large, big black markets, for these.
Well, I became convinced when there was this push for the late term abortions. Mm-hmm. You know, Kennedy, you didn't mention it here, and I'm going to make sure you get the link. Kennedy did an interview with somebody who was an expert on genetic engineering, and they were describing the details of basically birthing babies and then killing them to get the fetal material.
Teresa Deicher.
Right.
Yes.
Have you seen that interview?
Yes.
Yeah. And I don't think you mentioned it here.
I mentioned other articles. But
right.
Yeah.
But if you look at the push for late term abortions, that's basically allowing babies to be born and then killing the infanticide. That has to be driven by the demand for the material.
Yes.
And the question is, what did they need the material for? Was it stem cell, you know, underground stem cell? Was it was it the vaccines? Was it, you know, there's a series of possibilities of what it is, but it's clearly an enormous demand for this material.
Yeah, that's
it's a business.
Yes, that's why, like, I made a list of the markets that use stem cell right, technology. And if you look at the size of the markets, then, and you know they all have a need for fresh stem cells.
Right.
Then, what follows from it is that, yeah, it's a really big market. But if you look at, like, where they buy it, then on the website, you just see, like, oh, we follow all the rules and regulations, and it's all... legal, but you don't find out what they're really doing. And yeah, so you mentioned that interview with Risa Deischer. So a lot of other researchers have pointed this out too. Like, you cannot make dead cells alive.
Right.
So the cells need to be alive.
Right.
In order to do something with it. So they adjust the abortion method. And basically, there are quite a lot of testimony that these fetuses are alive when they harvest a cell, because otherwise it's not useful material.
So one of the most interesting things going on politically in the United States, you will see these state legislatures mm-hmm. who are trying to stop all the late term abortions mm-hmm. and even going, you know, to just outlaw abortion, period, mm-hmm. so that this can't go on. Mm-hmm. But they can't tell their constituents why they're stopping it. Because it's so bad and so gruesome, you know, and it's so secret, but they know. And so they're in this funny position. You know, everybody's in this funny position of having to debate a government policy and having to keep the real reasons on both sides secret.
There was a very good congressional report. It's in the source list. Because in 2015, there was this Planned Parenthood, they went undercover it was the Center of Medical Progress. They went undercover at Planned Parenthood, and that gave a lot of information about these practices.
Really?
Yes.
And in your hundreds of footnotes, which one? Farrell says, you know, footnotes are a good thing, so he's going to be very impressed with 259 exactly footnotes. Where is this?
His name is David de Leiden. Uh-huh. And this created like a lot of questions about these practices. And that initiated a congressional report. I think the chair was somebody from Kentucky, congressional chair. Because something that I was wondering about, but was difficult to find information, is that if the fetuses need to be alive, then there needs to be very close cooperation between the universities and the abortion clinics.
Right.
And this report details all the business models and the collaboration between these institutions to make this work. But it shows, like, it's a very thorough report, but it shows that there's a very big market. And then there was this other article that was talking about black market, that they say when there's very high demand and when there's low supply, then usually black markets emerge, and they compare it with the black markets for organ donations.
Right.
And basically they also say there is legislature that to deal with this, but there's no oversight at all. So this is an enormously gray area, because even Planned Parenthood is like, you're not allowed to make money on abortions, but you're allowed to have fees for your processing methods. So these fees are then very high.
Right.
So basically, I think it's Stem Express that was one of the major players in this. Basically, like, because the legislation is so in such a gray area, they could say, like, what we're doing is all legal because we weren't making money. This is all the technical cost. But it shows that.
So one of my questions was, the last time I looked to stem cell therapy in the United States was really using your own stem cells. You couldn't use other, you couldn't get the fetal. And so a lot of people that I knew of were mm-hmm. flying to China to get stem cells there. And my question is this material then being exported to a jurisdiction where they're free to do whatever they want?
There was one other article. So not all of it made the report, because I was going into this and it was basically thinking this is almost like a completely different.
Right.
But So there were these doctors in Ukraine in 2007, and this has been in the BBC, but it's not on the BBC website anymore. You have to go in Wayback Machines. But these doctors in Ukraine started wondering why so many women got the advice, like they said, well, there's something wrong with your baby, so it's better to abort it, and why the abortion levels in Ukraine were so extremely high. And a lot of babies were missing, and women were told, like, yeah, something was wrong with the baby, but they didn't even see the baby.
Right.
And they were like whistleblowers about these missing babies. And I think it's not the EU, it's the European Council, it's called. They launched an investigation, and there were enormous amounts of babies missing. That was an outcome of this investigation, and they also referred, or this article also referred to, the stem cell therapies in other countries.
Right.
So it kind of, yeah, suggested that Ukraine was also a hub for this kind of illegal.
Is there anything the Ukraine is not the hub for? It's unbelievable. Okay, so I want to get back to the issue of control, because mm-hmm. if you know, when you start reading this and you start understanding what's going on, you think, you know, this is all nuts.
Yes.
And then when you look at this from Mr. Global's point of view, whether it's the risk of, you know, whether the risk issues related to space travel or food self-sufficiency in the Middle East in areas like this, or, I mean, one of the things it's hard for people to imagine, but my experience working at the higher levels of Wall Street in Washington is I cannot express how afraid the leadership is of the general population getting hungry, organizing, and turning on the leadership. You know, the fear of guillotines is real. And nothing triggers the guillotines faster than hunger or food riots or famine. So there's real fear about not making provision. If you look at the planning that is done when they built the industrial agricultural system to make sure that there was plenty of food way ahead, and to constantly try and get more calories at a lower price, more calories at a lower price, more. And if you look at the history of food, the cost, you know, more calories at lower price has been, you know, has been a trend line. It's like lower interest rates and lower cost of energy. It's been part of the juggernaut of building up the sort of improvement in sort of quality of life, even though the nutrition was going down and, you know, the people eating weren't reading it. You know, while they were drinking their Coca-Cola, they felt very satisfied. Anyway, so, you know, they've put enormous investment and effort in trying to stay ahead of the hunger of the general population. But you can't imagine the fear that they feel on this.
Yes.
So when you look at all of this, if you understand that fear and you felt that fear, you know, risk management is looking down the road 20 years of a growing population and a rising Asia and the pressure that's putting on the food system. And they're thinking, how are we going to do this? How are we going to keep this trajectory going for another 20 years? So I can see why, from their point of view, you could say, well, you know, can we figure out how to make a burger in a bio, what's it called? Bioreactor. Sounds nuclear. You can see why they would do it. The other thing, though, which is even a greater push, is that if I want to do CBDCs, I can't build a financial transaction control grid with digital technology without controlling at least one asset. I'm losing control of the petrodollar. I need a replacement. You could tell from the Uruguay round of GATT on, they've been building, you know, they've been trying to control the food system through the patent system. That's not working. But this could work.
Yes.
Yeah.
I really think they need this controlled food system for people to sign up to CBDCs.
Right.
You already see it, so a lot of people are not being able to afford their food anymore.
Right.
So in the Netherlands, you can still go to these food banks without signing up for stuff. But in the US, you have all these government programs for food. And basically, to sign up for it, you have to give a lot of your data, you get a digital token. They, the Rockefellers, they have this report Reset the Table about how it all needs to be digitized and basically genomically tracked.
Right.
The production process itself, your own, like, food is medicine. So the doctors should be able to prescribe food as medicine. And then if you realize that they're really into pharma food, then that becomes pretty concerning. But imagine, and this was something else too, is that they cite all the children who are hungry, who are skipping meals. So as a parent, you want your children to be fed.
Right.
And then they said, well, these parents cannot feed their children anymore, so we need to make sure there are school meals. So that's in the US, but it's also a global program in the US. The EU has also signed up for this. And then they give the food education to children. And then you have the parties that are investing in these types of foods that are feeding your children. But they're really trying to put people into a funnel where, like, what do you do when you're really hungry? You're eating everything. Like in the Second World War in the Netherlands, people eat tulip bulbs because there was no food. So that's also, I hope that what people take away from this, if you look at all these angles where they try to create, like, there will be food, but will be really, really controlled. And you will only have access when you have signed up for a digital ID and a CBDC, that food independence is really, well, it's the key to our health, but it's also the key to our freedom. Like, right. If we want to remain free, then you need to be able to access your own food and know what is in it, and know your farmer, because if you will be dependent on these systems, I don't want to be dependent on that.
Well, the other thing is, if you get dependent on these systems, ultimately, you really don't know what's in this stuff.
No.
And I think what could end up being in this stuff is pretty frightening.
Yes. Well, if even what they're public about, then it's like they want to feed you cell lines and fetal calf blood and nanobacteria.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, the reason I like calling it pharma food is, you know, partly it's a play on words, farm. So this is not farm food. This is pharma. But the other thing is, we know enough about the pharmaceutical industry to understand that it's not a group of people we can trust.
Yes, because that's also, I was kind of surprised because it's still difficult to get it past legislation. And if you know how, after the last couple of years, how deeply corrupted our governments are, and that even in these corrupted systems, it's difficult to get this passed. But I also thought even if they pass this, then the same companies that approved of the injections, they are the companies that are providing oversight for this. So,
and the marketing firms doing the marketing for, you know, those. So we had a great Salera report on labeling last year and the problems with labeling. If you think the problems of labeling with GMOs is bad, this is unbelievable. So you touch on labeling in the report, but there are serious labeling issues, not just it, you know, lab-grown food getting in the food system, but using it on the pets and the livestock. And so it's getting, you know, so you read that it's a cow, but it's not a cow. It's a cow that's been fed with this stuff. And
yes,
it's getting in, you know, under the tent. Mm-hmm. It's just sliding in secretly.
Yes. Yeah, so for example, in the EU, it's difficult to produce GMOs, but they're allowed to import GMO soy and they feed it to cattle.
Right.
And like the insects are already part of cattle feed. It's allowed. Yeah, who knows this? So if you buy a piece of meat and you don't know what your farmer is feeding the cattle, then you don't know what they have been fed. And then with the labeling, So the cell cultured meat is not on the market yet. In the US, in the US, you're not allowed to call a GMO GMO. They came up with a new label, which is called bioengineered.
Oh, jeez.
But bioengineered, it's a really complicated way that it's labeled. So it's kind of like optional. Not in all cases, but the companies can kind of like assess for themselves if they are supposed to label this or not. But if it's so much processed that you cannot recognize the GMO in foods anymore, then you don't need to call it bioengineered. And then to show that it's bioengineered, there are like three or four ways to, like, it can be printed, or there can be a QR code, or there can be a little symbol, but they can choose. So there's not one way that they signal this. And you have to label it in principle, but there are all these exceptions. And so basically it's useless.
It kind of reminds me of FASB 56 in the US government. You look at the financial information, it's meaningless. Mm-hmm. So after reading her report, I said, that's it. You know, there's no, even trying to be expert in reading the label, it's not. You have to go back to finding farmers and knowing your farmers and buying direct. And, you know, you just need, I'll never forget when I was in Switzerland a couple years ago, one of the money managers that I love and work with or used to work with said, you know, finally, a group of the investment advisors I know and work with just threw up their hands and they said they had it. They bought a farm. They imported a farming family from Romania, moved them to Switzerland and said, you're in charge of growing all our food and, you know, or filtering it from the other local farmers. We're not. That's it. We're going to completely create a controlled local food system for our families.
Very smart.
Right. Very smart.
Yes. And also because some farms, they don't have the organic certification, but they have to.
But you don't need it if you.
Right. Like, it's better to talk with the farmer on what they are doing and with what kind of mindset right. than to look at the labels. Yeah.
Right. I'll never forget being up in the Jungfrau and seeing arguably the most beautiful cows I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. You know, they were just happy and beautiful, and the milk was unbelievable. Uh-huh. Anyway, so let me turn to the topic of inspiring you. You know, the question is, why should someone read this report? And one of the reasons you should read this report and share it with your family is it's time to get that epiphany. It's time to get the epiphany that those investment managers had. You need to rethink how you get your food, what food is, and how you're going to deal with this. You know, what's your long game on making sure your family's healthy?
Yes, and realize what they're doing with the food supply, because most of us just go to the supermarket and we right. think it's fine and it's reliable. But if you read what they're doing and the push behind it, because it's the VC money, it's the government, it's the regulation.
It's a $1 trillion tsunami.
Yes. It's enormous. And also, so there's no oversight. So if you realize what these parties are doing, do you want to be fed by them? That's basically the big question.
Well, it's funny. So the last topic I want to really get into is one that's very important to me. I'm about to do a recording with Tom Cowan on the issue. You know, it started with the issue of virus, non-virus, but it's a much bigger issue, which is we have a physical body, but we have an electromagnetic body, and we have an intelligent universe that communicates intelligence. And so it's not just the genes of our cells, our physical cells, it's the epigenetics of our electromagnetic and intelligent reality. And so much of what's happening in our society is being done by hypermaterialists who don't understand that this electromagnetic body exists, and they pretend it's not. I mean, you read these guys and they talk about a cell like it's a machine. A cell is not a machine. It's a living organism, and it's connected, you know, through electromagnetics with lots of other life going on. And so when you take living material and you and you deaden it and then you manipulate it in these ways, we have no idea what the electromagnetic impact can be on somebody who eats this stuff. And this could, you know, I read this and I say, if you look at what's happening electromagnetically, this could make you insane.
Yeah, well, there's actually quite a lot of research that already shows that that processed foods make you very sick.
Right.
So this is way beyond processed. So
right.
I cannot imagine that it will be healthy.
But it's based on a fundamental paradigm, which is antithetical to how life really works.
Yes. Yeah.
And we don't begin to understand what is happening with the electromagnetic life or body of this process and eating it. You know, we have no knowledge. I mean, I don't, and maybe Mr. Global has knowledge, but I, you know.
No, we have no knowledge at all. But there are also, there are no safety assessments.
No testing, there's no safety, there's no. So you have complete ignorance and a giant experiment.
Yes.
And you look at it and you say, what could possibly go?
Yes.
So you did an amazing amount of research, and you had before you started this report, but you've done an amazing amount of research, and it's an amazing report. And of course, we'll have it up on the website and then we'll publish it in the hard copy. This research fits together with so many different aspects of the things we've been talking about for the last 2 years, which is this control model. And one of the aspects of the control model it fits with is this thing called One Health.
Yes.
Which I don't understand, but you do. And I watched you give a great presentation to a group of the doctors explaining, because they're looking at One Health because of its relationship to the WHO's model of sort of controlling the world through, you know, pandemics and lockdowns and climate change. What is One Health? Where did it come from, and why do we need to know about it?
It's very important to know about it because it's a concept that's, it works at the UN, but it's also an infrastructure. So it's kind of a philosophy that says almost anything can be the origin of a pandemic. So there can be a human pandemic, that will be the WHO. But there can also be a zoonotic pandemic, so livestock that that is sick and the disease jumps to humans. And there can be diseases that emerge from nature, but the livestock can also be dangerous to nature. So if you look at the jargon, for example, in the lab-grown meat, is that they will say, well, there won't be any risk of zoonosis, of zoonotic diseases.
Oh, so it's... improves our safety.
Yes.
Right.
And there won't be antimicrobial resistance, which is not true, but that's their sales pitch. So basically then the UN says all these things can be the source of diseases. So we need surveillance or genomic surveillance to make sure that we catch things in time. And then all these UN bodies need to start working together to monitor these diseases and be able to initiate responses when they flag a risk. So where we saw that the WHO in 2020 said, well, there is a human pandemic, then in this case, from the One Health philosophy, they can say, well, there is a new mad cow disease, or there's the bird flu, which is... And then they can move in and basically say all these animals are sick and we need to get rid of them and the people need to go in lockdown again. But where this emerged was in 2007, I believe, the Rockefeller Foundation did a major investment in disease surveillance. They said we need better disease surveillance. And a year after that, they invested in the One Health philosophy. And again, with major investments. And this field has been developed like through conferences and webinars.
Right.
But it's part of the UN health policy. It's part of the EU policy. It's part of the US biosecurity policy. There are major laboratoria working on this. They trained veterinary networks in this One Health philosophy. So once you start reading this, you see that there's a major infrastructure already in place for calling out a zoonotic pandemic. And if you look at the changes in the WHO treaty, the proposed changes in the that did not pass through in the health regulations, they said that once there was a health risk flagged, the WHO could also work together with UNEP, which is the UN Environmental Program, with AIO, that's the animal program, and with the FAO, which is the agricultural program.
Right.
So instead of just calling out a pandemic and say everyone needs to go in lockdown, you can also assert control over the food production,
right,
and even about natural areas.
So the beauty of what the WHO is doing along with One Health is the central bankers need, before they can get to CBDC, they need a way to be able to manipulate demand destruction in very granular ways, or, you know, totally lock down the whole planet or lock down this piece or that piece or that piece, because they're printing so much money. They have such an inflation problem. They need demand destruction. I used to say Fauci was a demand destruction order taker. You know, is it 1 week? Oh, no, we're up. No, now this week we're like, you know, and they're calibrating the, you know, they've got, they need to constantly offset the inflation with deflation. And if you look at the machinery they're building through the WHO and One Health, it's brilliant. I mean, if I was the central bankers and I didn't want everybody to know it was me, you know, what a beautiful way to do it. You use health, you use food, and nobody will ever connect it back to the, you know, what does that have to do with the bankers? It's over here, it's health. So it's a great way of giving you the balancing mechanism you need to manage the economy until you get to the CBDC.
Yes, and and part of it is also this major investment in disease surveillance.
Right.
And that's why they also wanted all these developing countries that didn't have the resources to invest in this disease surveillance. They said, we need to help them get this up to par. But I think then, like, if enough countries have this disease surveillance, it's also very easy. Well, if you want to find something, you find something. And it's very easy to bribe somebody and say, well, there's the major risk right now. So, yeah, it's really an expansion of this WHO governance model.
So if you are the leadership and you're trying to do all these things and you're trying to do them in a way that keeps secret many of your reasons for doing them, which makes it much harder and more exhausting to do it, you've got to build a workforce and a consumer world that will go along with this. And I have to tell you, I would not want to have to attract a labor force to a lot of these companies. Because I would, you know, I just think there's a real natural aversion in the human race to doing many of the things that are going on. How do they build a labor force, and how do they acculturate people, young people in schools, to turn them into people who will go along with all of this?
Well, I think our schools are, and also universities, are already so indoctrinated. So they have very technocratic Agenda 2030 sustainability education.
Right.
So I have a sustainability background. My motivation was much more like classic environmentalism and not so much this technocratic Agenda 2030. But if I speak to people who are on universities, then they say they really bought into this stuff. Like they get it from the schools, they get it in the university programs. They are all on their cell phones. I think it's massive indoctrination, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
I came back with, from the United States, somebody gave me while I was there a book that was put, I think it was put out by the UN, but it was a book for sort of 7 and 8 year olds. And it was all about how, you know, animals and people were bad. And we had to, you know, I mean, it was really, it was amazing. It was one of the most, you know, you couldn't read it without getting a headache, and you can't imagine what a 7 or 8 year old would get from it. But I still think, you know, trying to attract a labor force to the bioreactor business and, you know, teach them to be that perfect, but also teach them to go along with creating huge vats of stuff that's throwing off hazmat waste for eating.
Well, they're developing all these university programs, and they tell them, like if we keep on with regular farming, then climate change is going to destroy us. So you're helping to save the world.
I don't know. Anyway, I think this is an amazing report. It's the first thing that got it, it made it possible for me to, you know, I always have it in the back of my mind. I gotta really understand this. And each time I try and, you know, look at these big mm-hmm. books to understand, and I'm like, oh God, you know, isn't there a documentary anyway? But your report makes it really understandable and accessible, and you know, so I'm really grateful. And I have a theory that we're going to publish this. You know, we'll put it up on the web, then we'll turn it into the magazine. We're going to put it out, mm-hmm. and it's going to trigger a amazing amount of information coming back into you uh-huh. About what's, you know, from people in the industry, people in the universities, yes. people who want to share what they know. I think you're just going to get an amazing feedback. And you know, you've tried to learn everything you can about how the cell lines are mm-hmm. working and whatever, but clearly there's a lot more to learn.
Yeah, I had a lot of questions. Yeah. So I described, based on the things that I read or the reports or the public information. But yeah, for me, like throughout the whole report, there are a lot of open questions.
Right. And so I just think you're on a learning journey now.
Yes.
It's going to be an amazing learning journey. You just have to make sure you know, really, you just don't do research during meals.
Well, what I really hope is that people, when they read it, that they realize how insane it is what they're doing to our food, and that they will be willing to invest in their farmers and
I told you that's what
food.
Pete Kennedy said. If we haven't inspired you to get to know your local farmer, this will do it.
Okay, good.
That's it. No, you're going to trigger a paradigm shift here, so I'm very grateful. Well, tell people how they, if they want to share information, how do they follow your work? How do they find you?
I have a website that's called www.vanhamelen, that's my last name, uh-huh. .eu.
Yeah.
And there you can subscribe to a newsletter. I was very active, but I haven't sent one in a while. But that's the best way to get up.
I can tell why.
That's the best way to get up to date. And I write for De Andere Krant, which uh-huh. is a printed newspaper in the Netherlands.
Very good newspaper.
Thank you. And it's in Dutch, so that's not very helpful. But I do videos, like interviews in English, and those are up on our Odyssey or YouTube channel.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And of course, there'll be a commentary where people can post questions.
Yes.
So I hope you'll log in and yes. follow what the chat is.
Okay.
Because we get amazing feedback and intelligence.
Okay.
It's just amazing what we discover from the subscribers. It's like, really? Really? Okay. Okay. Well, any other thoughts? Is there anything I forgot to bring up?
No, I think we covered the most important parts. Okay. Yeah. And it's a big report. So you really have to go through it, I think, to get the full picture.
So there was one, if I could only recommend one work from what you found. There is this one guy who wrote, I forget what it was.
Joe Fossler, The Counter. Yeah, that's a good.
He's the engineer that describes the how insane the economics are.
Well, the engineer is, I think, David Humbert.
Is he the one with the wall of nose?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
But it's Joe Fossler from the publication The Counter, and he interviews a number of chemical engineers, and they go through all the technical details. And you really come away from that where you think, this is not possible. And so I quoted a lot from this article because right. it was a very useful article. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, there's a wealth of resources if you want to follow. Okay. Well, Elsa, it's been an absolute delight. And we have more to do to get this report up. But I can't thank you enough for your work and your ability to connect the dots across many different worlds and sort of see not only what's going on here, deep dive what's going on here, but how it connects to the rest of the things going on. Because if tactically, if we're going to really do something and take our society in a more positive direction, we have to connect those dots and see this, you know, see this as part of a bigger effort to control centrally that has to be, has to fail. It just has to fail.
Well, I want to thank you for the opportunity to do this research, because usually I write like shorter articles and I jump from topic to topic. And it was very nice to do a deep dive. So I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, we have more opportunities to deep dive, so this won't be the last. Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on the Soleri Report. This is the annual 2022 wrap-up. This is our big theme. And check out the web presentation and the commentary. We'll have a transcript up. And again, I recommend this is an area you want to understand, but you do not want to bring it up at dinner. Enjoy your local fresh food.